as Pebble Beach Books.
Okay. Okay, where will they be?
Right out on the table out here. Each one has its name in it.
Kay, are there any people left in the hall? All stragglers welcome. Is that about it? Well, welcome to the beginning of our scientific program, and I have a series of announcements, and I deeply and sincerely hope that I won't get them too mixed up. For one thing, at the lunch today, there will be a meeting of the F.O. Schmidt Lecture Committee for the selection of this fall's Schmidt Lecturer. Then tomorrow, after lunch, in the library, there will be a meeting of those associates who are going to be able to participate in the site visit on May 8th. There is out in the hall a Pebble Beach book for each associate, which I believe, am I correct, Frank, has been signed by Frank.
And you
and they're not named, I hope.
What?
You mean, is there an associate's name in each one?
You bet.
So then you have to pick up your own name. Then there is a program change. On Tuesday morning, where it says that Professor Ploeg is speaking at 11 a.m., actually, Dr. Livingston will be speaking at 11 a.m., and his title is given on Wednesday morning at 9:50 a.m. In other words, at 11 a.m. Tuesday morning, Dr. Livingston will talk, and Dr. Ploeg will take the place that Dr. Livingston had at 9:50 on Wednesday morning. The purpose of this change is that Dr. Bloom has been deeply involved in this project on undernutrition and brain development, and Dr. Bloom, regrettably, will not be able to be here Wednesday, but he will be here Tuesday, and we wanted to make sure that he was here when Dr. Livingston talked. And I think, are there any other announcements, Kay, that I should make? And that, with that, then, I will turn it over to our chairman for the morning, Jerry Edelman.
Thank you.
Don't be close to the microphone.
No. Well, listening to the speeches at the banquet last night, reminiscent speeches, suggested to me that there's an awful lot of wishful thinking in the neurosciences of a very valuable type. And since Fred Worden has been trying, I guess as my part-time psychiatrist, to get me to tell an off-color story here for some time, I'd like to point out that Toscanini was probably one of the early neuroscientists because, as I said to Q this morning, one day he was conducting an opera and the soprano just wouldn't listen. And everybody who knew about the choleric nature of Mr. Toscanini knows what happened then. He threw the baton down, he screamed, he shouted. Finally, that didn't work, so he roared up onto the stage, and he didn't have much stature, physically, that is. And he confronted this huge soprano who had a rather generous embonpoint. And he found himself confronted, and he finally said, ah, if only these were brains. So, I have now discharged my function. I don't really have much to say, except perhaps one thing, the raison d'etre of this meeting. I first should say that it was Mac Ed's idea, and I was pleased that it was possible to draw attention to the subject to the associates, because it seems to me that we're in for a really radical change in the way we look at the membrane. There's no sense in making propaganda for the function and importance of the membrane to this group. When I say membrane, I mean the cell surface membrane complex. I mean the whole thing, not just the lipid bilayer. There have been several revolutionary ideas which aren't so much contradicting or contradictory to past experience as they are clarifying. The first one, you know, has a lot to do with an associate, Hardin McConnell, and that is the idea of fluidity. The second one has to do with the work of Brian Edigan and others, which is the idea of motion of receptors, both of which I think clarify and provide a ground for a number of other concepts. The most remarkable of which I believe is that even though cell surface receptors, and by this I'll take a rather vague definition of any protein which might bind or be bound on the cell surface. That's not really a strict pharmacologic definition of a receptor. That cell surface receptors are not, however, diffuse and not under control. They are, in fact, capable of being modulated. And these modulatory events, some of which you'll hear about this morning, are important, pervasively important, in a number of different areas. We are going to consider some evidence for modulation and influence on the area of mitogenesis, the control of cell division. We are going to hear about this kind of thing in relation to hormonal receptors. We're going to hear about it in terms of regulation of the cell cycle. And finally, we're going to hear about it in a quite direct application in terms of cell-cell interaction, all of which I think are justly and obviously of intrinsic interest to neurobiology. I noticed that neither Dr. Gospodarovich nor Dr. Jesse Roth is here yet. Am I wrong? And I'm keeping my fingers crossed. So I think what we will do, should they not arrive until after the coffee break, is ask Steve Roth to take Jesse Roth's place. It's a Garado and Garado. You know, you don't know which is which. And he represents the distinguished clan of Roths. Jesse, Steve, and Philip. So I hope you don't mind if that happens. But so without further ado, I would like to proceed. And just to say this, although I haven't spoken to all of the members, you might keep in your mind the possibility that, the heretical possibility that the lipid membrane per se is maybe the least interesting portion from the standpoint of specificity of the cell surface. And now I'll call on John Wong, who will give a little review on the cell surface, submembranous filaments, and cytoplasmic interactions.
Thank you, Dr. Hillman. Cell biologists have known for some time of the obvious importance in developmental biology of the events of cell division, cell movement, and morphogenesis via cell-cell interactions. Although controversy surrounds the subject, phenomena such as density-dependent inhibition of both growth and cell movement suggest that there may be a common connection at the molecular level, and that, indeed, that the cell surface is the locus of many of the proximate events common to these phenomena. Could I have the first slide, please? This would require that the cell surface, molecules at the cell surface, mediate signals from the outside world to the nucleus, and possibly also lateral signaling between receptors. Today, I shall describe some approaches taken by my colleagues, Jerry Edelman, Ichiro Yahara, Gary Gunther, and I, to study these phenomena using the tools of immunology and structural chemistry, and using the lymphocyte as a model. Lest you think that the lymphocyte is too specialized a cell, I would hasten to add that some of these studies have now been extended to fibroblasts and tissue culture as well. Furthermore, I think that some of the hypotheses that I'm going to raise concerning the modulation and dynamics of cell surface will apply to a variety of other cellular systems and would be of interest to cell biologists in general, including the neuroscientists. I shall confine my discussions to two main topics. First, receptor-receptor interactions as assayed by the modulation of receptor mobility at the lymphoid cell surface, and how this modulation system or the structures controlling this modulation may also mediate signals from the outside world to the cell nucleus controlling division and proliferation of these cells. The starting point of my discussion actually rests on two basic observations, those of Hardin-McConnell and his associates on membrane fluidity and also on Edidin's experiment on movement of cellular antigens in the plane of the membrane. There are two other developments, recent developments on the dynamic cell surface membrane structure, which point to higher order modulation events. These include the studies of Raff and co-workers on patching and capping, and also the work of Yahar and Edelman on the inhibition or modulation of patching and capping in the lymphocyte. Could I have the next slide, please? It's been shown by Raff and co-workers that when you treat a lymphocyte with molecules able to cross-link receptors on the cell surface, these receptors, originally in a diffuse or random distribution, come together to form patches, which can be visualized as fluorescent spots on the cell. These patches are eventually collected at one pole of the cell to form a cap in a polar distribution. Patch formation is apparently a diffusion-controlled process, does not require metabolic energy. In contrast, cap formation, a second event, does require metabolic energy and is subject to quite a few modulation events. Yahar and Edelman made a very striking observation about 3 years ago. That is, if you pre-treat the lymphocyte with a lectin called concanavalin A, and it's been shown for other lectins as well, since then, if you treat the lymphocyte with a lectin con A, prior to the addition of the fluorescent antibody, patching and subsequent capping is prevented. Let me show you the photographs of some patches and caps. Next slide. Mouse-pointing lymphocytes consist of about 60% what we call immunoglobulin-positive cells, or B cells. If mouse immunoglobulin is injected into rabbits, you can raise a rabbit anti-mouse immunoglobulin antibody. And this is conjugated fluorescein to be visualized for fluorescence microscopy. Initially, these receptors are in a diffuse state, as exemplified on this cell. They're cross-linked receptors gather to form patches, which are then eventually collected one pole of the cell to form caps. The Yahar and Edelman observation is that if you add con A, both patching and capping are prevented by the binding of con A. This phenomenon, this inhibition of patching and capping, is reversible for if the competitive inhibitor alpha-methylmanoside is added to release the con A from the cell surface, patching and capping can again occur. Furthermore, it has been recently shown that these patching and capping experiments can be done at the electron microscopy level. That is, both the movement of the cellular receptors and the inhibition occurs at this level of single receptors, not only at the level of fluorescence microscopy. Finally, I think it's important to point out that the inhibition of patching and capping, that is the blocking step, does not require metabolism, for this can be carried out in the presence of agents such as sodium azide. Well, we can ask two questions concerning this modulation phenomenon, the inhibition of patching and capping. What structural features of the con A molecule are required to inhibit patching and capping? And second, what cellular structures mediate these signals? To answer the first question, what structural features of a common molecule are required? We've attempted some structural studies and chemical modification studies, and I shall like to describe them in the next few minutes. Can I have the next slide? This is a side view of the Kane molecule. Kane is a tetramer made up of four identical subunits. This is a tetramer. One of the dimers of the tetramer is painted silver. The other dimer is painted in blue, one monomer, and red, another monomer. The interesting feature of this view of the Kane tetramer is that it shows the predominance of anti-parallel beta pleated sheets at the back of the molecule.
Say that more slowly.
Okay, one dimer and the other dimer painted silver and blue and red for the other dimer interact via an anti-parallel beta pleated sheet. The side chain interactions resulting from the amino acid side chains sticking out from this dimer interact with the corresponding side chains of the other dimer.
A beta pleated sheet. I wonder if you define that for Spaulding.
Beta pleated sheet is the
easel board if you want to draw.
Okay.
We have no chalk.
One of the striking models proposed by Pauling for folding polypeptide chains is the alpha helix. The other one is the beta pleated sheet. Beta pleated sheet consists of interactions between the carbonyl oxygen of the peptide bond group interacting with hydrogen bonds with the amino groups of another chain. In other words, this chain is running this way. Another chain could be running this way or this way, whether it's anti-parallel or parallel. Okay, but in any case, the basic structure consists of hydrogen bond between carbonyl, oxygen, and amino groups. And the chain could go like that with interactions, okay, and form a pleated sheet.
Thank you.
From analysis of the beta pleated sheet, it was seen that a lot of salt bridges were formed between the two dimers. And we thought that we might be able to break apart the molecule by preventing the formation of these salt bridges. So what we tried was a variety of chemical modification studies, particularly those modifying lysine and carboxyl groups. And we found derivatization of the Kane tetramer with succinic anhydride blocked amino group positive charges interacting with carboxyl groups, and indeed we were able to demonstrate that this molecule will fall apart when we treat it with succinic anhydride. Could I have the next slide, please? The Kane tetramer pH 7, upon treatment with succinic anhydride, falls apart into two dimers. Comparison of the binding specificity and the binding affinity of Kane and what we call succinyl Kane, the dimeric derivative of Kane. Comparison of their binding affinities for simple sugars, such as alpha-methylglucoside, showed that they bound with the same affinity. The only difference was that there were four binding sites per molecule on the native lectin and two binding sites on the derivative. While we tested the effects of Kane and succinyl Kane, we compared their effects on the initial observation that binding of this lectin will modulate or inhibit patching and capping. Can I have the next slide, please? In this experiment, the assay was again using fluorescent antibodies to cross-link molecules of cell surface to induce patching and capping. And under normal circumstances, you get 100% capping, that is, in the control, there was no inhibition. The addition of Kane inhibited capping in about 92% of the cells, which was the original observation. Addition of succinyl Kane to the same system, however, showed no inhibition at all. Now, as we analyzed the Kane molecule before The main difference we saw between Kane and Saxony and Kane was indeed the valence of the molecule. So we suspected that if indeed Kane modulates or inhibits pathogen capping by cross-linking receptors on the cell surface, one might expect that additional Kane, a succinyl Kane to the cell surface, and then further cross-linking of the bound succinyl Kane with antibodies to Kane might restore the phenomena seen with Kane. And that's indeed what was observed. In other words, Kane inhibited capping, while succinyl Kane did not. The addition of succinyl Kane plus antibodies to Kane resulted in inhibition of capping in about 40% of the cells. Furthermore, the antibodies could be replaced by the divalent FAV prime 2 derivative from a pepsin digest, but not by the monovalent fragment of the antibody. How will we interpret these results? Well, I think chemical modification resulted in two major effects. One is changing the valence. Kane has 4 binding sites, succinyl Kane has 2. The other effect might be due to charge interaction, succinyl Kane being a molecule of higher negative charge, and it might repel. We've also made another derivative called acetyl Kane of lower net negative charge, and this molecule behaves similarly to Kane. Succinyl Kane, excuse me. Acetyl Kane is also a dimer, but of lower net negative charge, and in these assays behave similarly to succinyl Kane. And what we conclude tentatively in this case is that the cross-linkage of receptors on the lymphoid cell surface is important, is one of the major factors in the controlling the receptor mobility as assayed by immunoglobulin capping. The experiments I've described so far leave unanswered the nature of the cellular structures mediating this effect. Actually, probably the most incisive experiment leading us to giving us some clue to the cellular structure comes from an experiment shown in the next slide. This is almost a paradox. I described to you that if you add Kane to the cell surface prior to labeling with a fluorescent antibody, you get inhibition of patching and capping. However, if you carried out this experiment by binding Kane at 4 degrees, washing the cells, and bringing the cells up to 37 degrees, not only was the receptor not inhibited from capping, but Kane receptors themselves underwent patching and capping. If you maintain the entire procedure at 37 degrees, that is, bind Kane to the cells, wash, keep the incubation at 37 degrees, no receptor capping was seen. So the phenomenon is capping when experiments were performed at 4 degrees, no capping at all when the experiments were performed at 37 degrees. There is some difference in the number of molecules bound between the 4 degrees and 37 degrees, but extensive titration studies have shown that even an equal number of molecules, or Kane molecules, bound to these cells, the same temperature effect is seen. Capping.
These are B cells.
These are B cells. However, the assay we're using is for fluorescent immunoglobulin, which is B cell. However, we've been able to also do using another cell surface marker called the theta antigen, specifically for T cells. In fact, the histocompatibility antigens occurs on most mammalian cell surfaces, also undergo patching and capping. They are also modulated by Kane. So these experiments seem to have generality in both the cell types and also the receptors that you're looking for.
Are there comparable temperature effects in T cells?
Okay. Somewhat puzzled, I guess, by these observations, the temperature differential effect. But nevertheless stimulated, Yahar and Edelman suspected that cellular structures such as microtubules, which might be sensitive to cold temperature, maybe mediating this effect of Kane. On this premises, they tested some drugs, namely colchicine and the vinca alkaloids, vinblastine and vincristine. on the inhibition of caffeine. Could I have the next slide, please? In this experiment, Con-A again inhibited patching in caffeine. In other words, we assayed for fluorescent anti-immunoglobulin in caffeine in the presence of Con-A, and no caffeine was seen. The addition of colchicine, or cosamin, which disrupt microtubules, allowed some caffeine to occur. About 30% of the cells showed caffeine in the presence of colchicine and Con-A. The effect was most strongly seen in the case of vinblastine, which 51% of the cells seem to have reversed. In other words, the inhibition by Con-A has been reversed by the addition of these drugs. If you irradiate colchicine with ultraviolet light, the compound is converted to an inactive derivative called lumicolchicine. Lumicolchicine does not disrupt microtubules in classical ultrastructure studies. And in this case, in our assay, it also does not reverse the effect of Con-A. On the basis of these experiments, a model has been constructed to explain the effects of Con-A, both the valence effect and also the drug effects on the cellular structures mediating the inhibition of patching and caffeine.
Can I ask on that last one, is there an experiment there with no Con-A? In other words, what does colchicine do to caffeine?
Colchicine has no effect on caffeine.
Independent of it.
In the absence of Con-A.
Thanks.
Could I have the next slide? Okay, this is a schematic representation of what we think might be going on at the cell surface and also the associated structures. Receptors in this model are thought to exist in two states, a free state able to diffuse in the plane of the membrane and an anchored state. Somehow, these receptors are anchored on a submembranous assembly of particles. These particles are thought to consist of both microfilament system based on Marty Raff's experiments and the effects of cytoplasm B, which affect microfilaments, and also based on Yahara Nadelman's experiments on the colchicine effect, so that these submembranous particles also consist of colchicine-sensitive microtubules. The addition of Con-A results in the cross-linking of receptors of the anchor type. Cross-linking of these receptors induces further polymerization of the microtubule assembly, which shifts the equilibrium of receptors from the free to the anchored state. And therefore, cross-linking of one set of receptors transmits a signal via the hypothesized submembranous assembly to another set of receptors, designated here by the open circle, shifting them from the free state to the anchored state, and thereby immobilizing them. Well, if indeed this system of submembranous particles, or what we call the colchicine binding protein assembly, does exist, then one would expect it to be a polar and cooperative one. And this experiment has been done in a very neat way by Yahara and Rudeshauser, and I'd like to show on the next slide. What they did was coat nylon fibers with a variety of reagents and tested the effect of local binding of Con-A to a small area of the cell surface to see if that binding of Con-A to a small area of the cell surface can modulate receptor movement over the entire cell. And I'm going to go backwards. In panel D is shown the binding of a lymphocyte to a nylon fiber seen in this part of the picture, coated with Con-A. This fiber is coated with Con-A. The cell is bound here and stained with fluorescent anti-immunoglobulin. And what you see is that the distribution of the receptors remain in a diffuse distribution. In other words, no capping and patching occurs. And Con-A's effect, by binding to a very small area of the cell surface, inhibits patching and capping over the entire rest of the cell. The addition of alpha-methylmanoside or colchicine, alpha-methylmanoside releases the Con-A from the receptors on the cell surface, or colchicine, which releases the microtubule assembly from the receptors, results in patching and capping again. Furthermore, this effect is not due to the fibers, for if you coated the fiber with a neutral protein, say, a dinitrophenylated bovine serum albumin, it doesn't have the Kanne effect. Patching and capping in these cells occur normally. So this experiment indicates that local binding Kanne to small area of the cell surface, the effect is propagated throughout the entire surface membrane. Well, I think what we must ask now is some conclusions on receptor-receptor interactions and receptor-cytoplasmic interactions, and what might the system be for. Could I have the next slide, please? I think that the points can be best summarized in this cell surface modulating assembly, what we call the system, is one, the distribution of cell surface receptors is affected by the state of the cell surface modulating assembly. A similar suggestion has been proposed by Berlin and co-workers on the basis of their experiments, which showed that colchicine and vinblastine inhibited the agglutination of polymorphonuclear leukocytes and fibroblasts by Kanne. The second point is, not only is the distribution of cell surface receptors affected by the state of the underlying assembly, but conversely, that the state of the assembly is affected by cross-linking interactions and aggregations of receptors at the cell surface. So it goes both ways. And third, it's almost a corollary of the first two, that alteration of the cell surface modulating assembly by one set of the receptors on the cell surface will affect the mobility and distribution of other receptors. So it's a message from the outside to the inside and back out again. Well, what is this system called the cell surface modulating assembly for? Does it play a role in mediating signals from the cell to the from outside of the cell to the nucleus? Does it play a role in modulating cell division? I'd like to present in the next few minutes some experiments, preliminary experiments, implicating that indeed that this cell surface modulating assembly also has a role in regulating cell proliferation. But before I go into that, I'd like to introduce you to some of the assays and preliminary results on the stimulation of lymphocytes by Kanne. Could I have the next slide, please? These are photomicrographs of mouse splenic lymphocytes cultured for 48 hours in the presence of Kanne. These are small lymphocytes, unstimulated or unresponding, non-responding to small lymphocytes. And these are blast cells, what we call blast cells, which have responded to Kanne stimulation. They undergo protein synthesis, RNA synthesis, DNA synthesis, and eventually mitosis. There's a whole host of biochemical phenomena going on in progressing from the small lymphocyte to the stimulated cell. Our assay consists of both identifying the blast cell, which has a much larger cell diameter, and also a less compact nucleus in fixed preparations. We can also assay for the incorporation of tritiated thymidine incorporated into cellular DNA by looking at the grains. Each individual dot represents a thymidine autoradiography grain. So using these two assays, blast transformation, which is looking at fixed blast cells staining with histologic stains, and also the incorporation of thymidine, we can assay for the stimulation of lymphocytes. Well, one of the earliest events in the stimulation of these lymphocytes by Kanne is binding of the lectin to the cell surface. You can prevent the binding of this lectin using the sugar alpha-methylmanoside. And in the presence of alpha-methylmanoside, Kanne results in no stimulation at all. The question we want to ask was first, how long must a cell be exposed to the lectin before becoming stimulated? Does it require a few minutes, or does it require hours? In order to do this, what we did... Could I have the lights just a minute? What we did was assay, stimulate parallel sets of cultures by adding Kanne at t equals 0 and letting the cultures go for 48 hours. But at different times after the addition of Kanne, we also added alpha-methylmanoside, the competitive inhibitor, to release the colonnade from the cell surface. In other words, we added alpha-methylmanoside to parallel cultures at various times after the addition of colonnade. The results of such an experiment, after addition of both colonnade and alpha-methylmanoside at various times later, we let the cultures sit in the incubator for a total period of 48 hours, at which time we assay for tritiated thymidine incorporation into cellular DNA. That's our assay. All of these cultures were assayed at the same time. The results of such an experiment shown in the next slide. And what we see is that addition of alpha-methylmanoside by preventing colonnade to bind to the cell surface at zero time resulted in complete inhibition of thymidine incorporation. Addition of alpha-methylmanoside later and later resulted in an increasing response. Therefore, the later you add the sugar, the less you can inhibit. Until at about 20 hours, no further inhibition is seen, no matter how much alpha-methylmanoside you want to add. So the question we asked ourselves were these points representing more and more cells becoming stimulated to same extent, or was it the same number of cells becoming stimulated to a greater extent? In other words, were more cells being recruited into stimulation? We did an experiment similar to this one, but this time, instead of only assaying for tritiated thymidine incorporation, we also took the cells, smeared them on a slide, processed them for histologic staining and autoradiography, and we counted the number of grains in each stimulated blast cell. The results of such an experiment is shown on the next slide. And what you see is that the total incorporation of thymidine, as well as the percentage of blast cells, increased in parallel with the time of addition of alpha-methylmanoside. The later you added alpha-methylmanoside, the less inhibition you got, and this corresponded to the percentage of cells being stimulated. More importantly, what we did was we counted the number of grains in each stimulated blast cell. And what it showed was that the average number of grains per labeled blast cell was constant. Could I have the next slide, please? What this experiment indicated to us was that first, that the rate of DNA synthesis is independent of the length of exposure to the lectin. Second, increasing number of cells become committed with longer exposures to colonnade. And finally, cellular commitment is an all or none phenomenon. This introduces us to the concept of cellular commitment, which I like to define as the process by which a cell becomes stimulated independent of the prolonged or continued presence of the mitogenic agent, independent of the prolonged presence of colonnade itself. Having established the kinetics of cellular
committed to what? To divide?
To divide, DNA synthesis and division. Having established this kinetics of cellular commitment, the response to colonnade, that is, not all cells respond in a burst in the first few minutes, nor is it all cells waiting for 20 hours to occur and then bursting at the same time. But rather, more and more cells as a function of time of incubation of colonnade becoming stimulated, becoming committed to stimulation. We then assay the effect of colchicine, which we suspected, based on our hypothesis on the cell surface modulating assembly, which we suspected might also mediate this signal. We tested the kinetics of that. Could I have the next slide, please? Okay, this slide.
May I interrupt for a second, because you're saying a lot of things.
That last slide.
Could it be that you have cells that are essentially in different states or different cycles or different phases or different moods?
Okay, I can.
So you wind up with all this linear kinetics, and in fact, it's not linear.
I can discuss that in more detail a little later on. In fact, we have made hypotheses on why. Well, this is the same.
You just stated one model.
Pardon?
You just stated one interpretation of the data.
Yeah.
Going on, I guess, at this time, but we've got to get on with it.
Fine.
You've just done one of the two alternative models.
I won't go into that, but we can discuss it.
I just have a quick flash of the last slide, because I had to figure out why one and two aren't self-contradictory.
The first one is per cell.
Oh.
And the second one is the recruitment of each cell.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's flip on to the next. Okay, this is the same experiment as the one you've seen, but now done with human lymphocytes for a variety of reasons of culture conditions. Again, we did the same experiment of adding alpha-methylmanoside to carnate-stimulated cultures at various times, and you see this is the same result as obtained before. Now, I'd like to compare it with the effect of adding colchicine at various times after stimulation with carnate. And what we found, indeed, was that the curve, form of the curve, very much resembles the cellular commitment as studied using alpha-methylmanoside. In other words, if colchicine inhibits, if the cell surface modulating assembly mediates this mitogenic signal by carnate from the cell surface to the nucleus, okay, one would expect colchicine to inhibit, block that signal. Okay, and indeed it does. I'll summarize in the next, don't flip, I'll summarize in the next slide that we have experiments indicating the colchicine effect on stimulation. However, I'd like to establish this right at this moment on the kinetics of cellular commitment as studied by alpha-methylmanoside, which is the earliest event. In other words, alpha-methylmanoside is releasing carnate from the cell surface. Well, right after the early event, that colchicine must block with a kinetics very similar to the alpha-methylmanoside one. Furthermore, my colleague Gary Gunter has done these experiments now, again, using the same histologic staining and autoradiographic assays at the level of individual lymphocyte. In other words, he's again counted the number of grains per labeled blast cell, and he finds that indeed, in this case, as well as in this case, that first DNA synthesis is independent of the length of exposure, and second, more and more cells become stimulated when you add colchicine at various times afterwards. Okay, on the next slide, I'd just like to summarize the results we obtained using colchicine in some of the salient experiments. We found that colchicine inhibits mitogenic stimulation early, before the blast cells appear, and also before DNA synthesis begins. That is almost implicitly stated in the previous experiment on the kinetics curve. Furthermore, colchicine does not act by killing the cell, inhibiting DNA synthesis, or blocking cell division. Third, the pharmacologically related drugs vinblastine and vincristine also inhibit, while lumicolchicine, which is the UV inactivated derivative of colchicine and which does not disrupt microtubules, also do not have any effect on the carnate stimulation. Inhibition by colchicine is reversible partially when the drug is removed. And finally, on the basis of analysis of the kinetic curves that I showed on the previous slide, we, at least at this moment, can say that colchicine blocks stimulation within a six-hour window of cellular commitment. At this point, we don't know whether it's in front or after the commitment event itself. Okay. Although there are a variety of possible explanations for the effect of colchicine on cultures of carnate with lymphocytes. In other words, what we're seeing is a stimulation event over a period of a few hours compared to an assay of DNA synthesis at 48 hours. Okay, there could be a host of mechanisms in which colchicine can block. But it's our present interpretation is that colchicine blocks by disrupting the cell surface modulating assembly, which has been implicated by the studies of Yahar and Edelman on the receptor movement. In other words, what we're trying to implicate is that the same assembly which modulate receptor movement at the cell surface is also mediating signals for proliferation. I think at this moment, I'd like to summarize on the next slide what this cell surface modulating assembly consists of. Well, certainly the receptors at the cell surface, which receive the earliest signals from the outside, probably not the intramembranous particles, since freeze fracture studies by Yahara have shown that they don't correlate with the movement of cellular receptors and the state of the microtubule assembly. But probably the assembly does involve the connection of receptors to a system of microfilaments and microtubules, and perhaps mediated in the middle by a myosin-like protein, in analogy to other experiments in other systems. If this indeed is true, that the signal for proliferation is also mediated by a mechanochemical assembly, such as the one depicted here, which modulates receptor-receptor movement, then one might suspect, one might have a basis for considering how cells in general use the cytoskeleton of itself. Cells can use its own cytoskeleton to control lateral signals at the cell surface and also surface-to-nucleus signal controlling proliferation.
Thank you.
Well, now we're open for discussion. We're running a little late, but we always do, so we'll try.
Hypothesized intermediate between microfilaments and the particles? I mean, can you decorate it? Does it decorate, or do you have any evidence at all?
Not in the lymphocyte system at this moment. We draw it from analogy on the can amoeba studies by Tom Pollard.
And the reason for putting microfilaments in at all is that cytokinesin stops it, or what?
Well, microfilaments are allegedly the machinery for movement of the cellular receptors.
The experiments of Stefanelli de Petris, two experiments. One is Stefanelli de Petris in Switzerland put cytochalasin and colchicine in and inhibited capping. Okay? Now, capping, you'll remember, is the systematic movement of aggregates of receptors towards one pole, in fact, towards the Golgi. In the presence of colchicine, capping is not inhibited. You perform patches, add colchicine, and capping will still occur. So that establishes the fact that the microtubular component is not necessary. His experiment, as well as Yahara's experiment, adding cytochalasin to fiber-bound cells, inhibits capping again without any further ado. So the model is that the microfilamentous structures, actin-like filaments, are actually the motive force.
But is there any evidence in other systems that microfilaments interact with microtubules?
There is no direct molecular evidence that I know of, except it is suspected in the spindle. People who have been looking at the spindle.
It's an interesting idea, but
this is a hypothesis. It's on the basis of a dynamic interpretation. There is no direct evidence, but the EM study that we did shows the following intriguing observation in a lot of cells, not just lymphocytes. 100 angstroms below the surface, you do not see microtubules, ever. You see microtubules everywhere else. In that space, you see microfilaments, network microfilaments, opposed to the inner lamella of the membrane as well as filling that whole thing. The molecular interaction of the two has not yet been demonstrated. It's putative on the basis of
two related questions. When capping occurs, is this associated only with the migration of one population of antigens or with all antigens?
And it's been shown that you can, if you have two types of receptors, you can cap them independently. In other words, you can cap with a green fluorescent reagent one set of receptors and stain for another set of receptors using a red fluorescent reagent. And you see them apart from each other. In other words, the green will be one pole and the red over the entire.
This means there is a private wiring system that connects a single family of receptors in the surface.
The wiring system in this interpretation consists of the ligand cross-linking them so that that cross-linked patch gives a signal to some kind of actin-like assembly, which is acting like a paint conveyor belt in a cabinet factory.
And secondly, related, you've talked about one type of experiment, but in general, if you suppress capping, are there parallel physiologic consequences to the cell?
If you suppress capping. There are two ways of suppressing capping, isn't it? Yeah. One is metabolism. That's not so good for answering your question.
No.
And the second one is cytochalasin. We don't think capping is important at all, except to denude the cell surface to what they call antigenic modulation. to denude the cell surface of that population and compel the cell to synthesize a new population of the same kind, which is an interesting problem of its own. But capping is a posterior event. It's not a molecular event by that time. It's a
vaguely reminiscent of what happens when one sperm gets into one egg.
Exactly.
Jerry, do you relate this assembly to the structure that Holger Hedin has shown us? John, do you relate that to the material that Dr. Holger Hedin has seen in the inside of cell membranes, that it has actin-like characteristics? And these are long strips and they're kind of a loose cordwood. And they tend to be aggregated, for example, at synaptic areas, where also are aggregated particles that are of interest to us.
I don't know, but that's certainly a possibility. In other words, we don't know the nature of the submembrane.
If that were the case, I would suspect that you would see some kind of order in the patching. In other words, linear arrays in favored instead of, as you appear to show.
John, I have to answer this because I know the thing he's talking about. It may be that in neurons, it may be that you might reflect on the possibility that, well, on two things. One is that a sperm cell, funny, you should mention that, a sperm cell doesn't have a mobile membrane. And the glycoproteins of a sperm cell show microanatomy. That is to say, they're held here, 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 and from species to species, different lectins paint them the same way, roughly, independent of the morphology, gross morphology. This cell is completely fluid. A neuron certainly must have the requirement that at the synapse, it's holding certain things here, modulating them, and letting other things go. And I would point out that denervation sensitivity and things of that kind certainly suggest that there has to be a dynamic process going on, and a machine even more sophisticated than the one we're talking about. Fred, I guess, first and then.
Sir, I wondered, does this model postulate that this subsurface assembly is a continuous sheet all around the cell, or does it go through the same changes that the receptors do, namely, is it diffuse and then patch up and?
No, one would suspect that this is a continuous network underneath the membrane. In other words, if you
across which all the patching and capping occurs.
Right. There may be local assemblies and dissociations, but one would suspect that this is entirely under the membrane.
Well, in the supracell, the erythrocyte, underneath the membrane is completely covered with a filament-type system. And there is considerable evidence that if you disrupt that filament-type system, you do change lateral distributions and mobilities of surface receptors. It seems to me that, just reciprocally speaking, if you, by an external force of cross-linking or something like that, you change the distribution, you've got to change the biochemistry inside the cell. Cyclic AMP and heaven knows what else. And my question is, how much of the stuff that you're talking about do you think is involved in normal lymphocyte stimulation? The cell sees antigens and wants to respond to them. So how far does this process have to go? How far do the receptors have to move? What's the order of magnitude?
One should start that out by saying that capping and patching are proven not necessary because succinyl CoNA mitogenesis, instead of going like this, goes like this, and it does not inhibit. And you can sample this population and you never see caps and patches, yet it's mitogenic. So we can rule that out.
Is there a subtle change involved?
Well, that's what one would have to conclude at this moment, that if it does occur, it must be micro level, in other words, at the level of the electron microscopy.
Relatively small number of molecules may be all that's necessary.
Right. John, do you want to comment on the role of calcium and the role of Chediak-Higashi syndrome?
Okay, I think I should like to make two comments. First, the work of Berlin, recent work of Berlin and co-workers on Chediak-Higashi syndrome, and also on normal polymorphonucleolocytes assaying by the capping of CONA again, implicates a role of cyclic GMP in modulating receptor movement. Now, the cyclic GMP will mimic the effect of Con A in certain cases. And furthermore, drugs which induce cyclic GMP level, rise in the level of cyclic GMP, antagonizes the effect of colchicine in the system. That's the first.
Cyclic GMP antagonizes GMP as it does in other
cells? I don't know of data on that.
It may be of some interest to neuroscientists that the first event you see in all of this is a pulse of calcium.
Somebody tell me what this syndrome is.
Chiyaki-Gashi syndrome is a dysfunction in endocytosis, fusion of endocytotic vesicles with secondary lysosomes. And therefore, the polymorphonuclear leukocytes, which endocytose particles, cannot fuse, and therefore they don't get the particles which are endocytosed do not get digested by the lysosomal.
Is this a syndrome that occurs in whole organisms or just
in it's mice? In humans and mice.
I guess also in emulsions, no one's tested.
And the second comment I make, I think he's already done so, is that agents such as calcium ionophores and also, again, agents which induce the cyclic GMP level rises help the Con A effect in modulation.
John, the experiments with the cells on the string, or perhaps other experiments in your material that you didn't tell us about, are any of them with sufficient resolution to theoretically derive a time constant for how fast the surface is frozen or how fast the cytosol can recognize immobilization of its surface?
No, we don't have any information on how fast this immobilization takes place.
In a microscope, though, in a minute, within a minute, you can tell. I haven't got it down to seconds, so I have to scan around. But within a minute, you can see. For instance, if you add the Con A in a drop, the total population will cap over 20 minutes at room temperature. But you can see cells which will cap almost right away. You will not see those cells the minute you add kind of a really strict kinetic experiment hasn't been done for reasons I think you can appreciate. But it's pretty fast, I should think.
On the premise that you've already suggested that the lymphocyte bound to the string is a tinge more like a neuron, say, than a free lymphocyte.
No question about it. Even looks like a neuron.
It's sort of like a big schmoop. It's got its synapse, and it no longer can divide like a neuron.
By the way, it should be noted that the cap on a neuron of that type, a schmoo-like neuron, is always opposite the fibrin. That's non-trivial. It relates to what you're saying.
Well, it's important enough to go back, if you would, for the, I guess, the fourth time in the hour, and give us once more the essential evidence that that binding site has an effect propagated throughout the cell surface.
Tell them about the latex particles, or perhaps.
Okay, I think there are three experiments that show the effect of local binding of Con A can modulate receptor mobility. The first is the Con A fiber. In other words, if you coat the fiber with Con A and bind the cell, okay, you can stain for Con A. That only occurs here. If you stain for fluorescent immunoglobulin, it occurs over the entire cell surface. Therefore, the local binding of Con A must modulate the entire system without Con A being distributed over the rest of the cell. The second one is Yahara has now done experiments using Con A latex beads and also Con A platelets. What he's done is coat platelets or latex beads very small with respect to diameter of the lymphocyte, which is about 5 to 6 microns. He's coated Con A with latex beads, and he's bound these latex beads to the lymphocyte. And when he binds a certain number of latex beads, say 10 of them, Con A coated latex beads to the lymphocyte, at only these areas, the rest of the cell is modulated, is inhibited from patching and capping. So both of these experiments confirm the initial observation that local binding of Con A affects the receptors over the entire cell surface.
I don't quite get your statement that the capping occurs at the opposite side of the fiber from which the con A is binding the cell to the fiber. I thought you said the wood capping wouldn't occur under those circumstances.
This is a T cell, this is a B cell. If you look at the whole population, the fiber will bind T and B. Forget these. These remain spherical and do not move. B cells, even though they're fixed here, undergo the most incredible movements. The textbook picture of a lymphocyte is foolish. That's a stained Ehrlich-type preparation. A lymphocyte undergoes the most incredible movements with constriction rings, little villi going out, and it's really very active. When you look at a moving lymphocyte on a glass surface, you'll see a hand mirror type cell with a structure called a uropod behind. There is a systematic movement of the cap into that uropod in a moving cell. That's other people's observations. When you link a lymphocyte to the fiber and allow capping to take place in the presence or absence of culture scene, you'll always see the uropod and the thing there. When you add culture scene, you convert this cell to a round cell, and if you allow it to cap in a separate experiment, the cap will form at random. This says that cell movement is not necessary for capping, only some inner actin-like movement. It also says that the position of the cap depends upon the direction the cell thinks it's going in. The position is not the same as the...
No, I think I should also clarify this. Those experiments in which the cap is formed opposite to the pole of the fiber binding site is done with a neutral fiber, i.e. a dinitrophenylated bovine serum milk. When you add the cell to a con A fiber, no capping occurs. That's right.
Well, the hypothesis, and it's only a hypothesis, is that maybe a whole bunch of cell functions are being modulated and mediated by one assembly, mechanochemical connected to metabolic events, presumably some kind of initiator which is released when you do all of this. That's, I guess we better leave it there in terms of Dr. Roth. My welcome. He's going to talk about signaling between insulin receptors and con A receptors to pack this energy.
I'd like to thank Dr. Edelman and Dr. Wong for inviting me here today. I'm a physician by trade, and so I have a certain orientation towards diseases and towards physiological aspects. I'm less sophisticated in the areas of biochemistry. What I would like to do is to give the neural systems are a major communication device, the hormones being another one. Let me talk about the hormones in general for a minute, give you an orientation to where we sit within the field of endocrinology, and then give several examples of modulation of affinity and numbers of receptors and how this might relate to biological sensitivity of target cells to stimulation. The hormones, for convenience, we divide them into peptides, steroids,
and tyrosine derivatives. And the tyrosine derivatives come in two types, the catecholamines, which I guess you're more familiar with, and the iodothyronines. Now, the reason, this is simply a chemical classification, but it's more than just a chemical classification. It really turns out to be a functional classification. So all the peptide hormones seem to be behaving in a similar kind of a way. They have a limited number of receptors located on the outer cell surface of the target cells. And apparently, the hormones don't need to get into the cells in order to act. For the steroids, on the other hand, it looks like the receptors are inside the cell, they're soluble in the cytosol, and they frequently, in fact, they appear to have to move to the nucleus in order to have their action. So the peptides and steroids are quite different in how they work. The catecholamines and the peptides seem to be behaving similarly, so that everything I say today, which would largely be about insulin receptors and a little bit about growth hormone receptors, I would like you very much to generalize to all the peptide hormone receptors. And that constitutes the vast majority of the hormones, so that, and also include the catecholamines in your generalizations about how these peptide hormones are working. Okay, the second thing I'd like to do is give another I guess this one is better seen. Let me stay with this one.
How about the iodothyronines?
The iodothyronines are really very much like the steroids. They seem to have to, they have cytosol receptors, which aren't well agreed on, but they all have nuclear receptors, and so that these two seem to be working together, and these two. The other thing is, I've been allocated 45 minutes, a half hour talk and 15 minutes discussion, but I'm perfectly happy to intersperse it so that anytime include my discussion time or my running time. The second, let me set up a simple-minded interaction. Hormone plus receptor acting reversibly to form this hormone receptor complex. The hormone receptor complex, the receptor has two functions. One is recognition. So the job of the receptor is to distinguish the active hormone from all the other molecules that it's being exposed to. So by calculation, about one out of every 10 million molecules hitting the cell is the active hormone. So it requires the ability to discriminate, this kind of discrimination, a 10 million to one type discrimination. And it serves that function of recognition by binding. Okay. The second function it has is activation. So the hormone receptor complex, it binds and recognizes, and then this complex must somehow activate the cell to generate some kind of events. Adenylate cyclase is the one that's best described. The other ones much less clearly described. Let's now look at a couple of things then. Let me keep this simple-minded reaction in mind. The bioeffect that we're going to see of a hormone is going to be some, let me put F, function of the concentration of hormone receptor complexes on the cell. And this concentration of hormone receptor complexes then is going to be by just simple equilibrium K equal HR over H times R, do a little arithmetic. What we'll find then is that the bioeffect is going to be proportional to the K, the affinity, the free hormone concentration, and the free receptor concentration. So that clearly all kinds of intracellular events can modify how big the bioeffect is going to be, but if we restrict ourselves to that first step, we're going to find three major things that are going to determine the magnitude of the bioeffect. The hormone concentration, that's obvious. Everybody knows that hormone concentrations go up and go down, and the bioeffect goes up and goes down. What I really want to stress today is the fact that the two other features of this reaction will also undergo major physiological modifications under things that we think are in vivo conditions. Namely, that the equilibrium constant is not constant. It's a variable that varies quite widely. And the R, the receptor concentration, will likewise be modulated under a whole variety of physiological conditions. And so that what I'd like to do then is agree that hormone concentrations will vary, but now put stress on the fact that these other two items will vary, and that these, in fact, will have major consequences in terms of what our dose response curves look like, what our cell responsiveness will be like. And what we're really saying is that a given cell, its sensitivity to stimulation can be varied very widely by manipulating both the affinity constant, affinity variable, and the receptor concentration.
I don't understand yes. something. The bioeffect is some function of HR.
Yes.
But HR is certainly a function of K.
Correct.
So why are you separating?
Oh, what I'm saying now is that...
Unless it's not equilibrium.
I'm just... Under something resembling steady-state conditions, the concentration of HR that you will form will depend on these three. And we're used to thinking about the fact that H will vary, but what I really want to show is that if you fix H, that K and R will vary. And I think that you brought up the question of denervation sensitivity. I think that some of the experiments will relate very clearly to this. The other thing I'll point out is that obesity, which is one of the models we're going to use, it's the most common example of a hormone-resistant state. It also has a severe behavior disorder associated with it, which is called overeating. And there may be even interactions between the biochemical disorder and the behavioral disorder. which will be in the realm of speculation, but which I'd like to raise. If I could have the first slide, this will introduce the insulin receptor. These were studies done by Pierre Frechet, who is now in Paris and who used to be at the NIH. Is that dark enough to be seen? Okay. On the left-hand side is insulin binding to liver membranes. On the right-hand side is insulin stimulation of glucose oxidation in fat cells. Let's look at the right half first. This is measuring stimulation of glucose oxidation in fat cells as a function of the insulin concentration. And here are six insulin analogs, but it's been done with about close to 40 insulin analogs, and the results are pretty similar. You'll notice that pork insulin is the most potent in stimulating, and that's pork, human, beef. Most of the mammalian insulins are quite similar in their ability to stimulate insulin functions in most mammals. You'll notice that fish insulin will do everything that pork insulin can do, but you need twice as much of it. In other words, it's got an affinity that's half that of pork insulin, but if you put in enough, you can perform all the functions that pork insulin does. Proinsulin, which is the insulin precursor molecule, is less potent. Desoctopeptide and desalinated, desasparaginated insulin derivatives of guinea pig insulin, these are all distinctly less potent, and the isolated chains of insulin are without any effect. And if you go over and look at insulin binding now, what you find is that pork, beef, and human insulins are all equally strong binding. Fish insulin binds half as well. Proinsulin binds about a tenth as well. These other insulin derivatives about a hundredth as well. And this turns out over a thousand-fold range of insulin potencies and over five orders or six orders of magnitude of concentrations is that the ability of an insulin analog to stimulate the biological function is clearly related to its ability to form a complex with the receptor. That once it forms its combination with the receptor, it's equally potent. So, for example, a proinsulin receptor complex is just as potent in stimulating a cell as an insulin receptor complex. It just takes 10 times more proinsulin in the medium in order to get that number of complexes formed.
Do the animals physiologically produce insulin proportionately, or does a guinea pig produce a lot more insulin than a fish?
That's really not known, and we're just starting to study why the guinea pigs got this bum insulin. And it turns out, interestingly, that the guinea pig makes a mammalian receptor. In other words, his own receptor prefers pork or beef insulin to guinea pig insulin. And so the insulin molecule is under very strong evolutionary constraints, but it looks like the insulin receptor is even under more evolutionary constraints than the insulin molecule itself.
Are the membranes or the cells in this case species specific, or are they the same?
These have to be rat liver membranes, but we've looked at avian, amphibian, human. We've looked at 8-10 tissues, whole cells, all kinds. It looks like the insulin receptor is pretty much the same in all of them.
So that even if you use
guinea pig membranes,
you would have got essentially the same.
Right. And birds, for example, make an insulin that's twice or three times as potent as mammalian insulins, but their insulin receptor is a mammalian receptor. And so that if we had turkey or chicken insulins on here, it would be further to the left. Okay, the next slide just shows a tabular form of, again, the same thing. Fat cells, glucose oxidation, liver membranes measuring binding, or lymphocytes measuring binding. And what you find then is for all these insulin species, there's a remarkable proportionality between them. And so the fact that lymphocytes have insulin receptors, it doesn't make a difference where you look. If I don't label the slide, I can't tell if I'm dealing with lymphocytes or muscle or fat or heart muscle or anything else. And I couldn't tell you species by looking at the data.
Jesse, just point on, when you talk about fat cell receptors, you're able to confirm that because you have glucose oxidation. When you talk about lymphocyte receptors, you really mean just binding them.
Correct. Okay, the next slide shows a simple effect on this K, and that's the fact that the insulin receptor is remarkably pH dependent. What this shows you is the vertical axis is insulin binding to the receptor, and you can see there's a pH optimum a little bit less than 8, and then in fact there are very sharp fall-offs in binding as you move away from the pH optimum. This has significance in human disease states in the sense that pH 7.4 says the normal extracellular fluid pH in diabetic ketoacidosis.
which is a well-recognized disease state associated with decreased sensitivity to insulin. In fact, with pHs of, say, 6.8 being a common occurrence, and in fact that being associated with a very marked deficiency in insulin binding to its receptor. The insulin receptor is very pH-dependent, but not so much salt-dependent. There are other receptors which are exquisitely salt-dependent. So the ionic milieu, even well within the narrow range of what we call pathophysiological occurrences in vivo, can be very substantial. And so that's a simple aspect of an effect on K. Let's look at the next slide will show you that this effect of pH seems to all be related to the dissociation rate. Namely, if you look at the dissociation at pH 7.6 or the dissociation at pH 6.5, you can see that almost all that difference in steady state binding is due to a marked acceleration of dissociation at the lower pHs. The next thing I would like to come to is the effect of insulin binding to its receptor on the affinity. And let me show you one slide of growth hormone binding to its receptors. The lymphocytes have both growth hormone receptors and insulin receptors, and what makes it nice is that they act as controls for one another. So I'll use the growth hormone receptor either to use as a contrast to the insulin receptor or to as a supplement to supporting the data from the insulin receptor. This is a plot of bound over free of 125 growth hormone as a function of bound. The advantage of this sketched type of plot is that the slope is proportional to the equilibrium constant, and the intercept gives you a reasonable approximation of the number of receptor sites per cell. You notice that this is a linear one, and when they're linear, it usually means that you're dealing with a homogeneous population of receptors. The next slide will show you ACTH binding to its receptor. These were studies, these were very early studies. As a matter of fact, these were the first studies of peptide hormone binding to a target cell.
What was N on the last slide?
I'm sorry?
How many? I didn't get the normalization.
There are a couple of thousand.
About a thousand.
Yeah. These are ACTH binding to its receptors in the adrenal. And if you, let's just look at the right half of the slide. You can see this very sharp break in the curve. And you can see that you can break this into two orders of sites. And so our interpretation initially of all these data of curve linear sketches was that we were dealing with two finite sets of receptors, each with its own affinity, each with its own number. And what we were seeing as a curve linear plot was just the summation of the two independent binding sites. And the next slide shows the insulin receptor, which is also a curve linear plot. And we interpret it simple-mindedly as two orders of sites. Pierre de Metz, a postdoctoral fellow from Belgium, didn't like our data. He didn't like the correlation between the kinetics and the steady state. He didn't like several other aspects of it, complained bitterly, and felt that we were probably dealing with cooperative interactions, namely that hormone binding to the receptor was altering the affinity. And the problem was that from the steady state data, you couldn't distinguish it, and there were really no good experimental techniques for distinguishing it. The next slide shows you the simple-minded experiments that he devised. What he said was, if we bind a small amount of labeled insulin to some cells, that if you now dilute to infinity, the dissociation of these labeled species should not make a difference then whether you dilute it to infinity or you dilute it to infinity in the presence of an excess of cold hormone, namely that occupying these receptor sites, all these other empty sites with cold hormone, shouldn't in any way affect the dissociation of the previously bound hormone if each receptor site was independent of every other. Whereas if occupying these sites now somehow got the message to these sites that they were occupied, we'd expect some change in the dissociation rate. And the next slide will show you such an experiment. On the left is the growth hormone system. We had a linear scattered, which we reasonably expected might in fact be an ideal statistical mass action system. In fact, if you bound a small amount of growth hormone, labeled growth hormone to these cells, let them come to steady state, then it says 100-fold dilution. I won't show you the data, but I promise you it's the equivalent of dilution to infinity. 100-fold dilution, and if you 100-fold dilution with all the empty sites occupied, you get exactly the same dissociation rate. So occupying the empty growth hormone receptor sites has no effect on the dissociation of the previously bound growth hormone. On the other hand, with the insulin system, you can in fact see that if you dilute, you get a slow dissociation. However, if you occupy all the empty sites with unlabeled insulin, you markedly accelerate the dissociation. So that, in fact, the various insulin sites do know whether the sites are occupied or not. There are lots of controls to show that there's no rebinding in any of these experiments, and I won't show you those. But let me show you a couple of the other curious things about the system. You can skip this one and skip the next. I was just worried that the color slide wouldn't show up, but since it did, I can skip this one and the next. Okay, this one, fine. This shows the dose-response relationship. The vertical axis is acceleration of dissociation by the addition of some concentration of insulin. And this is the insulin concentration that we're talking about. Now, first of all, notice that small concentrations by physiological standards, a little more than 10 to the minus 10 molar insulin, is already causing discernible acceleration of dissociation. This constitutes occupancy of 2 to 5% of the total sites, is already starting to cause acceleration of dissociation. As you add more and more insulin, you get increasing amounts of dissociation, and this brackets what would be the whole pathophysiological range of insulin effects. You do notice, though, at very high concentration, there's a reversal. Namely, as you start to add more and more insulin now, you get less and less acceleration of dissociation. Think about about 10 to minus 4 molar insulin, where this, the dissociation here is just like dissociation by dilution alone. This descent is associated with insulin dimerization. So the equilibrium constant for insulin dimerization, which is around 10 to the 6th, so that you've got a half maximal fall off at 10 to the minus 6, which is where you expect it. And in fact, this curve of fall off exactly parallels the dimerization of insulin. It'll become important in mapping the site.
So that may I ask a question about the earlier business?
Sure.
Interpreting the increased rate of dissociation as an effect of an interaction between receptor sites. Mm-hmm. Suppose there were only two receptor sites and they were both occupied by labeled hormone, and then you add a lot of co-hormone. Hormone combination is reversible, wouldn't by mass action an increased concentration of the hormone cause an increased dissociation?
Well, I think you saw the growth hormone system, which is a simple system where, in fact, there's mass action. In fact, the only thing that determines the dissociation is the time dependence of the... it's not dependent at all on free hormone concentration.
Off-rate.
I mean, it's not the off rate. I recognize it's not intuitive, but if you set up, the binding rate is going to be proportional to the forward rate constant times hormone times receptor minus the reverse rate. So this is what determines the rate of dissociation, and it's totally dependent on HR only and the dissociation constant. It doesn't have a term for either H or R. That only determine. So that in fact, with dilution to infinity or dilution in the presence of cold hormone, you should get no dependence on free hormone concentration.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Does insulin stimulate the release of growth hormone?
No. Which is nice about these cells. They've got built-in controls. It also does make this easier with whole cells or purified plasma membranes or which cell type you look at. So all this is an intrinsic characteristic of all insulin receptors we've looked at. We've looked now at about 8 different insulin receptors.
But insulin does not stimulate the release of growth
hormone. Correct. Okay, now, so in the whole physiological range of insulin concentration, insulin is a monomer, and you can see that as you add more and more, fill more and more sites, you get an increasing dissociation. The next slide will make that point a little stronger. What the Mets did was to use two insulin derivatives which don't dimerize at all. So tetranitroinsulin and guinea pig insulin. It's again another peculiarity of the guinea pig. It doesn't bind zinc and it doesn't dimerize. Funny beast. What's plotted now on the vertical axis then is acceleration of dissociation. The horizontal axis is insulin concentration. What you can see is that the tetranitroinsulin and the guinea pig insulin, you need more of them in order to occupy as many sites or to accelerate the dissociation. But you notice when tetranitroinsulin doesn't double back on itself, even when you go to higher concentrations, and likewise, guinea pig insulin will not, whereas all the other insulin derivatives, when they start to dimerize, will now show the fall off in effect as they start to dimerize. So the dimerization process, which covers certain regions of the insulin molecule, though they're capable of occupying the insulin receptor, do not generate these site-site interactions. And I'll show you now a few more derivatives which have lost, although they're capable of occupying the bioactive receptor, they won't cause the site-site interactions. So first I'll show you the general rule, which is that most insulins will occupy the bioactive receptor and generate bioactive responses and proportionately generate these site-site interactions. And there'll be a few that will be exceptional. They can bind to the bioactive site, they can generate bio messages, but won't have the site-site interaction. The next slide will just show this proportionality now. On the left is inhibition of, on the left-hand side is occupancy of the bioactive receptor. You can see that insulin, fish insulin, a pro-insulin derivative and pro-insulin will bind in proportional to their bioactivities. On the right-hand side, you see acceleration of dissociation as a function of insulin concentration. And you can see that these curves are really quite superimposable. So for these four insulin derivatives, at least, then occupancy of the bioactive site and generation of bioactive messages is exactly proportional to their ability to stimulate, to set up these site-site interactions. The next, and that was true for almost all the insulin derivatives that we looked at, which are several dozen.
Do I understand that you run the control that says that the number of receptors does not increase or decrease during this?
Correct. Now, if you look at these two derivatives, there's octopeptide insulin and deiodinated deasparaginated insulin. They can occupy the insulin receptor site. They stimulate bioactivity. They have a funny-shaped curve, and it'll turn out that we saw this curve very early on in our work, namely the fact that there's octopeptide insulin and deiodinated deasparaginated insulin were not parallel to all the others. They had a steeper binding curve. And sure enough, they do not accelerate dissociation at all. Okay? They're capable of forming dimers and other things that insulins do, but they, while they do occupy the biological receptor, while they do produce the biological effects of insulin, they do not cause site-site interactions, they do not cause any change in the dissociation rate of labeled insulin from the receptor sites. And the next slide will just show a two-dimensionalization of the three-dimensional picture of insulin. This is the X-ray crystal graphic structure of insulin. The blue amino acids are the ones that are species invariant. In other words, that they undergo no changes throughout the evolutionary course of insulin. The yellow amino acids are the ones where either in dimerization or in desoctopeptide insulin, despentapeptide insulin, or desalanated, desasparaginated insulin, where the insulin molecule retains bioactivity but loses its ability to cause site-site interactions. And so what it looks like really is that that the bioactive site, although it's not, the bioactive site of insulin has not been as well defined, it's only defined this limited way of the invariant amino acid sequences, that the bioactive site is adjacent to the site that causes site-site interaction. But in fact, what it says is the functional data say that there's one region on the insulin molecule and one region on the receptor which are necessary to get together to get your biological effect, and there's another region on both the insulin and on the insulin receptor which cause the site-site interactions, the acceleration of dissociation, the falling off of K. So what it says then is that when the insulin receptors... Can I have the lights on? What it says then is that when the insulin receptor sites are all empty, they have their highest affinity, that as you start to increase the insulin concentration, so you occupy some of them, and by some of them you only need a few percent occupancy, that then the affinity of the entire receptor population decreases. And as you progressively increase the amount of insulin in the medium, progressively fill the sites, that the affinity progressively falls off until you get about 20 or 25% occupancy, at which point it's in its lowest affinity. And then for the remainder, filling of the remainder of the 75% of the sites, it remains in this low occupancy state. And so it's acting then at the dose response level is as a buffer against increasing insulin concentrations. That is, with increasing insulin concentrations, you will get less filling than you would have expected for just that increase. And the same is true, obviously, as the insulin receptor concentration is being decreased.